Good afternoon and welcome to the American Constitution Society Wisconsin Voter ID Call. Today's presentation is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Katie O'Connor.
Hello, everyone. My name is Katie O'Connor. I'm the Assistant Director of Lawyer Chapters here at the American Constitution Society. Thank you all for joining us, especially on such short notice, for this conference call. We are thrilled to be joined today by Jim Eichner, Managing Director of Programs at Advancement Project, and Charles Curtis, Jr. and John Ulin, both partners at Arnold & Porter. These three attorneys and a few of their colleagues represented the plaintiffs in LULAC of Wisconsin versus Denninger, which challenged Wisconsin's voter ID law. The court handed down its opinion in the case on Tuesday of this week, and we're going to hear today the details of the decision and how it's likely to impact ongoing voter ID litigation across the country. I won't waste too much time handing the call over to our experts, but I do want to remind you briefly about a couple of things. First, we're going to have a voting rights training CLE next Friday here in D.C. If you're interested, please email me at koconnor@acslaw.org. Also, our national convention will be June 19th through 21st at the Capitol Hilton, and we would love to have you join us. Information is on the website at acslaw.org. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Jim Eichner first.
Thank you, Katie, and thank you for ACS for inviting us to talk today. I also want to thank my trial partners, John and Chuck, and the law firm of Arnold & Porter. We couldn't have done the case without them. And since I know I have a bunch of lawyers on the call, hopefully maybe this case will get them interested in doing pro bono work. I think anyone who's helped out on a voting rights case has found it a great opportunity, and unfortunately there's lots of need to sue to stop bad voting laws. So if you're interested, Advancement Project is always looking for help. I also want to note the work of the ACLU, both of Wisconsin and nationally, who tried their claim along with ours and is also responsible for the great result in Wisconsin. So I just wanted to start by trying to put the decision in kind of a broader context and talk about a few things that I think are noteworthy about it before turning it over to John to talk a little more about the nuts and bolts and Chuck to talk about sort of what's next. So I think one of the most important things about this decision is it's part of a growing tide of decisions that we are seeing striking down voter ID laws. We won a case, Advancement Project recently won a case in Pennsylvania, and just this week the judge reaffirmed his decision. Also this week a judge stopped the Arkansas voter ID law. We are in the process at Advancement Project of putting the final touches on a preliminary injunction brief in North Carolina, and there's litigation in Texas, and I think our win-loss percentage is getting better and better, and I think that's a trend that can continue. And I think the Wisconsin decision shows the themes of why these legal challenges are being more successful. And I think that the main thing is that as these laws play out and as these laws get stricter, the facts are clear that these laws place a big burden and that there isn't any justification for them. And I think faced with that, courts are finding it easy to strike them down. So on the point of burden, these laws, wherever they are, hurt people who are poor and particularly voters of color. And Wisconsin's a good example of that. The judge found that there are 300,000 voters, registered voters in Wisconsin who don't have ID, which is 9% of all registered voters. And he notes that that's double the margin of victory in the 2010 Senate and governor elections. So these are big numbers that have a big impact. There's also a big racial impact. Black registered voters are 50% more likely not to have required ID than whites, and Latinos are 150% more likely. So there's a big disparity, and we put a human face on this problem by having a number of witnesses come and tell about the burden on them, and John will talk a little bit more about that. And I think that's a key part of the litigation strategy that we and others have employed, is to make this as real as possible. And that's why I think early on there was less success in challenging these, that people tried to do them as facial challenges and didn't develop the record. And we did the opposite here. So in addition to there being a big burden, as the judge in Wisconsin found and we made a great record on, there's no justification for these voter ID laws, despite the sort of trying to sort of play bait and switch by some of the proponents. Voter ID only prevents in-person voting fraud, people showing up and trying to vote as someone else. And that just doesn't happen. To the extent there is types of fraud, it's not that type of fraud. And so in this case, like in Pennsylvania, the state of Wisconsin was unable to point out a single case of voter impersonation fraud. And it's silly to think that there's somehow lots of this going on and it's undetected. The state's own witness, who was an investigator in the Milwaukee Police Department, he was asked if some types of fraud were hard to detect. And he mentioned a couple forms of fraud, but he did not mention ID. So even their own witness thought it was silly to think that that this was especially hard to detect. And, you know, we rely on crime statistics for things like white-collar crime fraud, and we don't think that that's undetected, even though they're kind of simple. And as the judge said here, you have to be insane to commit voter fraud. There's no real gain for you, and there's a high penalty if you get caught. He also found, and I think this is a very important point, that it's the false hype of voter fraud, not actual fraud, that undermines confidence in the elections. So what you have here in these voter ID laws is a big burden on voters and no government justification. And under almost any legal standard, that isn't going to survive, whether it be under a state constitution or under the Equal Protection Clause or under Section 2. But to me, that's one big takeaway of this case. Another is that, and very important for Advancement Project, which is a racial justice organization, is that this case reinforces the importance and viability of Section 2. We've long believed that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is the most appropriate tool in many cases to fight voter suppression, because most of these laws are designed or at least have the effect of discriminating against voters of color. You know, whether you want to call that intent or not, I think that if you pass a law that you know is going to disenfranchise minority voters, that's a form of intent. If you've seen the clip on The Daily Show from the gentleman from North Carolina, sometimes they spill the beans on what's really behind these things. And so I think it's important to sort of challenge these laws as being racially discriminatory. And when we were thinking about bringing a Section 2 claim in this case, some of our colleagues in the voting rights world tried to talk us out of it, and there was a sense that Section 2 couldn't be used against voter ID, which has always been a little puzzling to me. I never understood why that would be true. Section 2 has broad language. It applies to any voter qualification that results in denial or abridgment and has a disproportionate impact. That's ID in a nutshell, and particularly voter ID looks a lot like the poll taxes from the earlier days that were exactly what the Voting Rights Act was meant to protect against. So I think Section 2 clearly applies, and this is a very important case because it's the first time that Section 2 has been used to strike down voter ID. There was a previous case, the Gonzalez case, in which there was a challenge under Section 2, which was not successful. But in that case, the record was not developed to the point that it was in our case. And so we think this shows that if you develop the record, you can win under these cases. And John will talk more about the Crawford case, but I think it's true for that as well. And so I think this leaves Section 2 as a clear, powerful force going forward, and there's a good opinion for judges to cite. So I think that'll, you know, not only be important in the cases in Texas and in North Carolina, but it also will make it clear that you can challenge other types of voter suppression measures under Section 2. Just yesterday, the ACLU filed a suit against Ohio for cuts in early voting and same-day registration under Section 2, and that's similar to the claims we have in North Carolina. So I think it's important that people see that as a viable cause of action, and that as judges start to recognize it, it'll become more and more powerful. Section 2 is especially important after last summer's gutting of Section 5 by striking down the preclearance formula in the Shelby County case. And so this case is also important because it's the first Section 2 claim post the first trial in a Section 2 case post Shelby County. And even though the state of Wisconsin was not subject to preclearance, it shows that Section 2 is a viable way to stop laws in the aftermath of Shelby. We think there should be restoration of preclearance because it's hard for parties like us to spend all their time litigating these cases, but it shows that states are not going to get away with these passing these laws. It'll just take more doing on the part of people like Advancer Project. So that's the second thing I think is important about this, is what it means for the future of Section 2. And the last point I'll make is that one of the most interesting things and gratifying things about this case to those of us on the LULAC case is we were very concerned during the trial that there were efforts in the state legislature to amend the voter ID laws in ways that would not actually fix the problem, but might be said to moot out our claim. And we were worried that it would be kind of a moving target, that we would have to keep going back to court, and Wisconsin, because they threatened to have a special session, would keep changing the law. And the judge made it clear that he was not going to be not look kindly on that. We asked him to hold jurisdiction to look at any changes, and not only did he agree to that, but he made an incredibly strong statement that not only did he think this law was violated Section 2, but that he thought any version of photo ID would be discriminatory. He said, given the evidence presented at trial showing that blacks and Latinos are more likely than whites to lack an ID, it is difficult to see how an amendment to the photo ID requirement could remove its disproportionate racial impact and discriminatory result. And so we think that is huge, and it has had the effect, according to press reports, of causing the state of Wisconsin to realize that it would be folly to try and amend the law. So that's, I think, very good as well. And it makes it, I think it's an important principle that, you know, these laws are broadly unconstitutional and discriminatory, and that the burden on should be on the state to show that they have fixed any taint. So those are my big picture thoughts about this, and I'll turn it over to John Ulan for a deeper dive.
Thanks, Jim. This is John Ulan from Arnold & Porter. I'll start also just by saying it was an honor and a privilege for us to litigate this case, to work with the terrific lawyers at the Advancement Project and our colleagues at the Deckard Law Firm and the ACLU who litigated the companion case with us. And thanks also to the American Constitution Society for having us speak about the case today. I'm going to talk briefly about two things. One is our litigation strategy, how we developed it and implemented it. And the second is what Judge Lynn Edelman of the Eastern District of Wisconsin held in his 90-page opinion and why he held that. I want to start briefly by talking about my friend Lorene Hutchins. She was the star witness at trial. Lorene passed away earlier this year and unfortunately didn't get to see the decision that was issued, but she was a huge part of it. Lorene was 93 years old. She rose from her hospital bed to tell her story to the court. She was brought in a wheelchair to the center of the courtroom. She couldn't descend the witness stand. The judge came down from the bench to see and hear her story. She was born in Mississippi when black voting was not welcome. She told the story of her husband and her brother being turned away from the polls by a white mob when they tried to vote for Franklin Roosevelt. And that was an inspiration for her to become politically involved. And she voted consistently after moving to Wisconsin in the 1940s, and also worked the polls for the state of Wisconsin for years, telling her friends she knew their votes counted because she counted them herself. Act 23 threatened to disenfranchise Lorene. She didn't have a driver's license because she stopped driving many years ago. And she couldn't get a new one because she didn't have a birth certificate. She was born to a midwife in the rural South at a time when one in four blacks born under similar circumstances were never issued a birth certificate. Fortunately for her, her daughter, Catherine Clark, was very strong-willed and spent many hours and hundreds of dollars communicating with the state of Mississippi and finally obtained a delayed birth certificate for her mother, and then they were ultimately able to get a driving license from the state of Wisconsin that Lorene did not need except to satisfy Act 23. In other words, as Judge Edelman so eloquently held, the law required her to buy a license to vote. I want to put this case briefly in the context of Section 2 and past voter ID challenges, just elaborating a little bit on what Jim was talking about. Section 2 is most commonly known for challenges to vote dilution, at-large districts that submerged minority voting strength when minority voters could elect a representative from a well-drawn single-member district, or redistricting plans that fragment minority voting strength. Because of that predominant focus on vote dilution, there's been some question about whether Section 2 reaches vote denial claims, claims that laws prevent people from registering and casting ballots but don't necessarily affect the results of elections. And it's a very ironic question because it actually was the converse issue that confounded voting rights adversaries in courts for years until Section 2 was amended. It's now widely accepted that Section 2 reaches vote dilution. But it's also pretty clear that even the adversaries of the Voting Rights Act believe that Section 2 reaches vote denial. So Justice Thomas in Holder versus Hall, who's very skeptical of vote dilution litigation, finds that Section 2 clearly protects against misuses of aspects of the voting system that could be manipulated to deny citizens the right to cast a vote, cast a ballot and properly have it counted. Similarly, Justice Scalia in Chisholm versus Romer found that Section 2 is violated when a state adopts a voting procedure that makes it more difficult for voters of color to register or cast their ballots than it is for white voters. Of course, that's exactly what happened under Wisconsin's voter ID law. There's also some question about whether voter ID laws can be challenged under Section 2 because it doesn't outright deny the vote. After all, people can get an ID. Justice Scalia was pretty clear in Chisholm that similar voting procedures obviously violate Section 2. So he wrote that if a county were to permit voter registration only 3 hours one day a week, and that made it more difficult for blacks to register to vote than whites, that would violate Section 2. The legislative history of the Voting Rights Act tells us that if you were to put the single polling place for a county in a white country club miles away from where blacks and Latinos predominantly live, that would violate the Voting Rights Act. Similarly, case law tells us that where counties that are predominantly minority are forced to use unreliable voting machinery while reliable modern voting equipment is used in predominantly white counties, that violates Section 2. Again, in each of those scenarios, all of the voters can figure out how to comply with the law and cast their ballots, but the disparate impact on their voting rights violates Section 2. So a practice, an election practice, can violate Section 2 if it unfairly burdens the ability of voters of color to register and vote, even if it does not outright disenfranchise them. Of course, Act 23, Wisconsin's voter ID law, does both things. In developing our arguments and litigation strategy, we were mindful of prior voter ID challenges, what was argued, what the courts held, why they fell short. And the two cases that stood out predominantly for us were Crawford against the Marion County Election Board, the Indiana case that was litigated in the Seventh Circuit and ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court, and also Gonzalez versus Arizona, which was litigated in the Ninth Circuit. Crawford was obviously not a Section 2 case. It was a 14th Amendment equal protection claim. And the court balanced the state's interests in its voter ID law against the burden imposed on voting. And the Seventh Circuit and the Supreme Court both found that the state of Indiana had a legitimate interest in preventing voter impersonation fraud, and also ultimately that requiring voter identification was tied to that interest and was an acceptable burden on the right to vote to protect the state's interest. It didn't burden voting too much. Interestingly, both Judge Posner, who wrote the Seventh Circuit decision, and Justice Stevens, who wrote the Supreme Court majority opinion, have found that, or have later commented, that they felt they didn't have a sufficient factual record to evaluate the real impact of the Indiana voter ID law in the Crawford case. They didn't have evidence before them that allowed them to understand that voter ID is recognized as a means of voter suppression, not fraud prevention. They didn't have proper evidence to understand the effects of the law on voters or the absence of voter impersonation fraud, factual evidence that would support the state's asserted interest and the law. Similarly, in Gonzalez, which was the Section 2 case, the court found that statistical proof that minorities possess identification less frequently than white voters do is not enough to prove a violation of Section 2. The plaintiffs have to tie that disparity in ID ownership through evidence to a disparate impact on voting, and because that evidence wasn't present in the Arizona case, the plaintiffs lost. We took those lessons to heart in developing our strategy for presenting evidence, and we developed a three-tiered strategy. First, we put on experts and on three basic subjects. We put on experts who testified about the statistical impact of a voter ID law on all voters in the state of Wisconsin and then specifically on voters of color. What are the percentages of people who lack ID? And among the people who lack ID, what are the percentages of those who are black and Latino? That was done both by comparing voter records against ID records from the Department of Motor Vehicles and also by telephone surveys of two separate experts. We put on an expert who testified about the absence of voter impersonation fraud in the state of Wisconsin, notwithstanding significant enforcement efforts. And then finally, we put on experts who told the story, and this becomes particularly important in the context of Section 2, of the history of official racial discrimination in the state of Wisconsin discrimination with respect to the right to vote. Second tier of evidence, we put on evidence from community service groups and elected officials about their efforts to work with particularly the black and Latino community, to educate them about the voter ID law and to help them navigate the voter ID law, obtain the necessary IDs if they needed them, and understand what needed to be presented at the polls, and the special challenges that the law imposed on the communities that they served. And then finally, the third tier of evidence, people like Lorreen Hutchins, many of them came forward into the court, black and Latino, and actually some white voters, to testify about their own experiences attempting to comply with the voter ID law, whether they had the necessary documents to obtain an ID, the burdens that they faced in terms of traveling to multiple government offices to obtain an ID, spending money obtaining documents that were necessary to obtain that ID, the burdens that the law imposed on them to obtain both identifying documents and a state-issued ID that they really didn't need in their daily life and certainly didn't have. And the only reason they were getting it was because the law required it now in order for them to vote. Judge Edelman focused a lot on the testimony of those individual voters and community service groups about to establish what he found to be the burdens that the law imposed on them, and also recognized from our expert testimony that there's a calculus of voting, that voting is not something that people see tremendous benefit in, and therefore slight increases in the administrative burdens on voting can have significant impact on whether people actually get out there and vote. And that was very influential to him in understanding what the real burdens of the voter ID law were. He also found that these burdens were not justified by the state's purported interest of preventing voter impersonation fraud. So Professor Lorraine Menitti, who's the nation's foremost expert on voter fraud, testified that she had studied all of the reported cases of potential voter impersonation fraud in Wisconsin and found that there really was no evidence of it. At most, maybe two unexplained irregularities per general election in the entire state of people trying to vote a ballot under a name that had already cast a vote in that election, and that they were almost always explained by poll worker error. Similarly, the state's own witnesses testified that they had spent a lot of time and resources on enforcement against voter fraud and found no voter impersonation fraud. Ultimately, everything that they had explored had led to poll worker error, and ultimately there were no prosecutions. So the court found the state may have an abstract interest in preventing voter impersonation fraud, but it can't justify a law that burdens voting rights based on an illusory concern with no factual evidence that it actually exists. With respect to the 14th Amendment violation, that was all the court really felt he needed to find. The burden imposed by the law on voting was not justified by an unsupported justification, and the 14th Amendment was violated. The factual record was before him that was absent in Crawford, and he could find a 14th Amendment violation. With respect to Section 2, the court found, based on statistical evidence, that the burdens of the law fall more heavily on black and Latino voters than they do on white voters. You heard expert testimony that black and Latino voters more often live in poverty and more often live in the urban core of Wisconsin's cities. Therefore, they drive and travel less. They need IDs and licenses less frequently in their daily lives, and statistically, the truth of the matter is they possess them less often. That was corroborated by the matching analysis of motor vehicle files and voter files to determine the numbers of registered voters who actually didn't have ID according to the state's records, as well as by telephone survey evidence. And the court was able to conclude that black voters in Wisconsin are 40% more likely than white voters not to have a qualifying ID that would allow them to vote under the voter ID law, and that Latino voters are 2.5 times as likely as white voters not to have a qualifying ID. That was the sort of statistical disparity that led the court to believe there might be a Voting Rights Act violation if it could be tied to proof that it actually prevented people from voting. Again, the sort of evidence that was absent in Gonzalez versus Arizona that we strove to put before the judge. And the judge was able, based on testimony from community service groups and from the voters themselves, to find that the absence of IDs did, in fact, impact the ability of blacks and Latinos to cast ballots in the state of Wisconsin, and that disparate impact, again, moving us further down the road, closer to a Section 2 violation. The last key point that he needed to analyze was, does that disparate impact on black and Latino voters result from the effects of discrimination? And here, expert testimony informed the judge, and he was able to conclude on the basis of it, that residential patterns, disparities in income, poverty levels, education, and healthcare outcomes all exist within the state of Wisconsin, all favor whites over blacks and Latinos. That is, conditions in all of those measures are better for whites than blacks and Latinos in the state of Wisconsin, and that all of those disparities, as well as the residential patterns, are the result of both historical and recent discrimination within the state of Wisconsin. And they combine to make blacks and Latinos less likely to see the benefits in voting, more likely to be deterred by added burdens in voting, particularly more likely to be burdened by a voter ID law because they are more likely to lack identification. And going back to the tiers of evidence, again, the community service groups and public officials, as well as the voters themselves, came in to give the real-life testimony of their own experiences or their experiences in the community during election season to corroborate what the expert said. So taking the level of expert testimony, some of which was present in the Arizona case, and bringing it down to the ground level, letting the judge hear the actual stories from people who work in those communities and were active both during the time that Act 23 was, the voter ID law was enforced for one election, and more generally in the community over time. Last point, the judge focused on the question of whether the state policy that purported to justify the law was tenuous, and whether what Judge Adelman found, obviously, was that prevention of non-existent voter impersonation fraud is a tenuous state policy. And he concluded that, as a result, the state policy didn't justify the burdens that the law imposed, and therefore a Section 2 violation. Therefore, he could find a Section 2 violation. And in that finding, I would say it's the only place where we have some philosophical difference with what the judge held. Our view is that under Section 2, if a law disproportionately burdens minority voting rights, it violates Section 2. It must be struck down, even if the state has a valid justification for it. Section 2 requires the state to support its policies in ways that do not burden minority voting rights. There's no balancing. Judge Adelman imported a balancing test into the Section 2 analysis, perhaps relying on Judge Posner's opinion in Barnett versus Chicago, which effectively does the same thing, but found ultimately, as he did in the constitutional claim, that the state's illusory interest couldn't satisfy its burden of justifying what otherwise was pretty clear to him a violation of the Voting Rights Act, and therefore he found Section 2 was violated. So that's more or less what our strategy was, how we think it impacted the judge in this case, and why we think we had a very successful result. And with that, I'll turn it over to Chuck for any comments about what happens next.
Thank you, John. This is Chuck Curtis calling from Madison, Wisconsin. I'll keep my remarks very brief so that hopefully we'll have some time for some questions. But in terms of what happens next, there are at least three arenas in which this controversy over Wisconsin's voter ID will now be fought. The first arena, of course, are the federal appeals courts. The Wisconsin Attorney General has already announced that the state will appeal to the Seventh Circuit based in Chicago. He has also said that the state will ask for a stay of Judge Adelman's injunction. It is possible, although no announcement has been made yet, that the state will request an expedited appeal. So there's one arena. At the same time, this law is also being challenged in the Wisconsin state courts. And in fact, there is a state injunction presently in place. The Wisconsin Supreme Court heard arguments challenging this same law under the state constitution. The Supreme Court heard arguments in late February of this year, and a decision is expected probably by the end of June or early July. The third arena, Jim has already mentioned, the Wisconsin legislature. Prior to Judge Adelman's decision, Governor Walker had stated on a number of occasions that if the law was struck down, he would call a special session of the legislature to amend the law, and we would all start all over again. As Jim said, Judge Adelman agreed with our suggestion that he retain jurisdiction and emphasized that if the state does enact a new version of voter ID, the state will need to go back to him, file a motion to lift the injunction, and as Jim said, Judge Adelman expressed real skepticism that the state could come up with anything that would satisfy his concerns. So that's a very brief overview of the different arenas in which we will now move to. And with that, I will turn it over for questions.
Yes, thank you. Please press star 1 on your phone to ask a question. Make sure your mute button is disengaged to allow your signal to reach our equipment. That is star 1 to queue, or star 2 to exit the queue if your question has already been answered. We'll pause to give everyone an opportunity to signal.
While we're waiting for some questions, I think one of the questions that I've heard from some of the people that are on the line by email is, you know, we have a lot of cases pending and also a lot of voter ID laws that haven't yet been challenged or that have been unsuccessfully challenged. How do you see this decision impacting voter ID laws in other places, if you have thoughts on that?
This is John Ulam. One, I think, very important takeaway here is Judge Adelman went out of his way, and admittedly it's a Wisconsin-specific finding, but it's one that's going to have broad implications, to expose as a factual matter the fallacy of voter impersonation fraud. And obviously those findings are going to be reviewed on appeal. But assuming that they stand, and I think there's a pretty good chance they will, given how factually detailed his opinion is and well-supported it is, that finding is going to be very significant for other cases because the principal justification for these laws has been the prevention of a type of fraud that really isn't happening. And now there's a very well-supported, factually supported judicial finding that it's not happening.
I agree with that, and I also hope that, you know, some legislatures will sort of, in places where they haven't implemented them yet, they'll have second thoughts, and I hope also it'll embolden more legal groups to bring suits. I think people have felt like there weren't a lot of tools, legal tools, to bring, and I think the recent success shows that state constitutions and equal protection and Section 2 are all viable claims.
Jim, you mentioned to me that there's a round of briefing getting filed next week in North Carolina, and you had indicated that the timing of this decision was good from that standpoint.
Yeah, it's actually, the briefing got delayed, I think, yesterday or the day before. It's a couple more weeks, but it's very timely because there's preliminary injunction filings in North Carolina against the law there, which is really we refer to it as the mother of all voter suppression laws because it not only has ID, but it also has custodial voting and same-day registration. And we think that's a strong case there. And I think, there's a tendency of federal judges not to want to be first. And now that Judge Adelman is first, we're hoping that other judges will feel like it's okay to pile on and to cite him and to, be emboldened to make that ruling.
As a reminder, it is star one for your phone questions today, and we'll go to Emma Simpson.
Actually, it's Jerry Hebert with Emma Simpson, so I'm going to take the lead here. I'm wondering three questions. One is that if you could describe the efforts you made to find individuals, like the powerful testimony that was described of bringing someone in at 90-plus years of age and so on, and how to find those people. Secondly, did you give any thought that the court might not hold the law unconstitutional or violative of Section 2, or if it did, seeking less than a full injunction blocking the law from going into effect? In other words, maybe having the court craft some ameliorative ways that the law could be implemented, but it wouldn't have the harmful discriminatory impact. And then thirdly, could you just tell us what the length of the trial was? Thanks very much for your work on this very important case, which many of us will be citing in the days ahead.
Thank you, Jerry, for that question. I'll start, and then, John, Chuck, you can jump in. In terms of how to find powerful witnesses, I think, we did this case on behalf of four organizational plaintiffs, and I think that's the key for a group like us that is based in Washington. I mean, Chuck's in Madison, but we at Advancement Project are here in D.C., is you really need to work with people on the ground in places. And a number of our most powerful witnesses were affiliated with Cross Lutheran Church, or we knew them through various networks. We had an organizer who was the unsung hero of this case named Charlotte King, who helped us find a lot of people. And, people were really brave in stepping forward and telling us their stories. It just requires lots of good old-fashioned legwork. We talked to a lot of people who referred us to more people. And, it just takes a lot of time and really working with people in the community who know people, because, people were sort of nervous about testifying, and those relationships were crucial. We did not really think about seeking ameliorative measures. I think, our view is that any form of ID is improper and discriminatory, and we don't really want to be in the business of suggesting it's okay. And I think Judge Adelman got that. And, I think one of the most important things is on the question of in ruling on standing in this case, he said that even if you have ID, having to show ID is a burden. And so, it's not a question of denial, it's a question of burden. And our great expert, Barry Burden, talked about the calculus of voting, and even very small burdens, given how people value voting, sometimes can dissuade them from voting. And so we want to remove burdens altogether. And the judge ultimately found that it was not his place to change the law, but also signaled that he didn't think the law could be changed in a way that was not discriminatory. And on your last question, the trial was 2 weeks, but that was in part because Judge Adelman is a very, very hardworking judge who in my experience, never needs to go to the bathroom. And so we started and we worked late and we did no breaks. So I feel like we did about 3, maybe 4 weeks of trial in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'll second that. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah, I was going to say, just to give you the statistics, in that 2 weeks, we put on 43 fact witnesses, 6 experts, and several hundred exhibits into evidence. The trial transcript alone was close to 2,200 pages long. John, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's all. No, that's great. That was helpful. The only thing I would add in response to the first question about finding witnesses, very true, I agree completely with Jim. You need strong community partners on the ground, especially for people like me. I live and work in Los Angeles. I don't have, you know, the connections in Milwaukee, and I can only be there, you know, a few days here and there, as opposed to the folks who are actually out there and know who to contact to develop witnesses. I think one also needs to evaluate the strengths and weaknesses of your evidence and where the holes are. And I think we benefited a lot from that sort of brainstorming, which enabled us at various times to say, hey, we don't have a level of witness that, for example, like our community service organizations or elected officials who have, you know, who are in their own way experts about the communities that they serve and can tell a story to the judge that perhaps an individual voter can't, or bring color and specificity that an expert can't. And then I just think, for you know, brief war stories, Chuck and I spent a lot of time, even as outside counsel, on the road in really sort of old-fashioned civil rights litigation, meeting up with, you know, African American newspaper editor at a coffee shop in a small town in Wisconsin, going to board meetings of LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, because we felt that the very, very powerful Latino story was not going to be told well enough. So that's the sort of follow-through I think that was necessary here.
I would just also want to add that in addition to the efforts of Jim and the Advancement Project and of John and me and of the various organizations we mentioned, we had a number of associates from our firm who periodically parachuted into Wisconsin and engaged in the same kind of, you know, walking the streets, going to various people's homes that we did. And I think they found that a terrific experience and also a welcome break from the normal large firm associate routine. But we had associates from several of our offices who just did, you know, terrific work. And as I hope we're giving you a sense of, Jerry, in response to your question, I'm just struck by how time intensive this work is, because, you know, for every witness, good witness we found, you know, we probably talked to 6 or 8 or 10 others who, you know, some who didn't have a story, some, you know, may have had a story to tell, but there were problems with their testimony. So it's incredibly time intensive.
And we have no more questions in queue.
All right. If there are no further, oh, actually a couple of people seem to have questions now.
Yes, we'll go next to Chris Falcon.
Hi. Very briefly, I was just wondering about the specialties of the expert witnesses that were used at trial. Thank you again.
So there were basically three groupings of expert witnesses, and I say groupings because in two instances we overlapped with our colleagues from the ACLU, and in one instance we put forward a single witness that served double duty in the two cases. So there were experts with respect to the statistics, ID ownership, whether as a pure statistical matter, Black and Latino voters tend to own IDs, state-issued photo ID, less often or per capita than do white voters. And then also among the voters who lack ID, what are the statistical disparities with respect to whether they have the documents or can obtain the documents that would be necessary for them to get a photo ID, typically a birth certificate. So typically the question was, do you have a driving license or a state-issued ID card? If not, do you have a certified birth certificate? Those were, it's somewhat broader than that, but at its essence, those were the questions, and then what are the disparities among whites on the one hand and blacks and Latinos on the other hand. Those experts were, on the one hand, a political demographer, basically a consultant for political campaigns, a fellow named Leland Beatty from the state of Texas, who was very, very powerful, asked some very, very common sense, pragmatic questions, performed a matching analysis of voter records against DMV records. That was really essentially the same matching analysis that a poll worker does, taking a look at the driving license to see whether it matches the voter roll. So his testimony was relied on very heavily by the judge in determining the percentages of people who actually lack ID. He also analyzed among the people who he found who were lacking ID how that broke down by race, and that testimony was credited by the judge. Professor Matt Barreto from the University of Washington, who is actually a very well-known voting rights expert, testified in a number of cases over the last decade or so, did a telephone survey of registered voters in the county of Milwaukee to determine whether they had qualifying ID and, if not, whether they had the documents necessary to get it, and also took important statistical information like the race of the people that he was interviewing so that he could perform an analysis of what the disparate impacts were. So that's one grouping of experts. The second grouping of experts, or the second expert who served double duty in both cases, was Lorraine Maniti from Rutgers University in New Jersey. And as I mentioned, she's the nation's leading expert on voter fraud, all sorts of voter fraud, not just voter impersonation fraud. That's just one type of voter fraud. And she had done extensive studies prior to the litigation, including in the city of Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin, about whether there is any incidence of voter impersonation fraud. And she had studied every reported incident of irregularity that might be voter impersonation fraud over a period of more than a decade, and concluded completely independently of this lawsuit and prior to it ever being filed that there was no such evidence, and she was able to reconfirm that by refreshing, based on her research, but also refreshing it on more up-to-date information. And then finally, the last set of experts, Professor Mark Levine from the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee, and Professor Barry Burden from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. By the way, if you can use Barry Burden really for any purpose, but especially in a voting rights case, he is both a brilliant scholar and an excellent testifier. Their principal responsibility was to testify about the so-called Senate factors under Section 2, the evidence of historical discrimination with respect to people of color in a particular jurisdiction that gives the court the background to be able to determine whether a voting practice interacts with that history of discrimination in such a way that it deprives black and Latino voters of an equal opportunity to participate in the political process. And they gave that evidence very powerfully. I think the other thing which Professor Burden gave, which was part and parcel of that, was focusing both historically on the evidence of discrimination against both blacks and Latinos in Wisconsin, but also providing a construct for that Senate factor analysis, and that was what I think both Chuck and Jim referred to, the calculus of voting, this cost-benefit analysis, reinforcing for the court that scholars generally have accepted wholeheartedly the principle that there is a cost-benefit analysis, that the benefits tend to be not viewed as not very significant in voting, and they can be diminished by all sorts of factors, including from an impoverished black and Latino perspective, the observation that your government is not responsive to you, that you're not getting the services, and that you're not living at the same standard as white citizens are, or frankly, that the government would be willing to pass a voter ID law that you know from your own personal experience is going to disproportionately impact people in your community.
And we'll go next to Nathan Foster.
Afternoon, gents. I think you just touched on my question. I was going to ask what you made of the fact that Judge Adelman didn't really dive into the Senate factors. Does that sort of mean that you could put on a Section 2 case without diving into them, and they really only apply to vote dilution, or do you think that was just sort of happenstance of his addressing the Constitutional and Voting Rights Act claims in tandem?
This is John Ullman again. I'll try to be brief. And by way of full disclosure, Nathan is one of our associates at Arnold & Porter and was a critical part of the trial team, put on witnesses and very, very effective in a lot of different ways. Judge Adelman clearly is skeptical of the notion that you need to prove the Senate factors in order to establish a Section 2 violation in a vote denial case. The reason that the Senate factors exist is to allow courts to understand why vote dilution can still violate people's voting rights. And that is to say, the people are still allowed to vote, so there is, at least from an original perspective, some disconnect between being allowed to vote and simultaneously having your voting rights abridged. And the Senate factors were significantly designed to help courts analyze and understand how a law that doesn't prevent people from voting, like a redistricting plan or an at-large district, can nonetheless abridge their voting rights. And they're all developed out of vote dilution cases, mostly from the Fifth Circuit in the 1960s and 70s. And so there's a lot of question about whether they apply at all in vote dilution cases. Vote denial cases, where people are outright prevented from voting, and whether it's really even necessary to get into the context when you can just put up statistics and demonstrate to the court that there is a statistical disparate impact with respect to voting. End of story. You should win your Section 2 case. The judge raised some questions in his opinion about whether it really is proper to analyze the or necessary, I guess is what I would say, to analyze the Senate factors in a vote denial case. But he didn't really come out and say that it wasn't necessary or required. We did not take a position on whether it was required. And what we felt as a trial team was we ought to embrace the Senate factors because the story they tell is very effective for us, the story of the historical discrimination and disparate conditions for voters of color in the state of Wisconsin reinforced our story to the court about the burdens that a voter ID law puts on those voters and the impact it will have on their ability to participate in the political process.
I would just echo what John's saying to the point that even if they don't have any legal significance, anyone who does one of these cases should put them on because they tell the story and they put the ID law in the broader context of the societal discrimination that turns a facially neutral law into an engine of discrimination. And it was some of the most powerful testimony. So, you know, even if it's not necessary, I would say that it's important, at least in setting the stage for the story and for your case. And I want to echo also that Nathan did a great job in the case, and I have also been remiss in not mentioning my Advancement Project trial partner, Lee Chapman, who was also instrumental in finding witnesses and spent so much time in Wisconsin that in a month she became a frequent flyer of AirTran because she went back and forth between D.C. and Milwaukee so much.
I just want to reinforce one point Jim made, which is I think – I found in, you know, just casual conversation with friends about this who sort of have the, uninitiated perspective, what's the big deal you present an ID? At some level, that's right. What's the big deal you present an ID? But when you understand the context that there are particular communities of people that don't have those IDs that are especially burdened by this law and that there's no real justification, there's no fraud that's being prevented, those facts, all of which are germane to the Senate factors, provide the context within which, even in casual conversation, you get beyond the simple reaction of, you know, what's the big deal? You're just being asked to present an ID.
And in the interest of time, this does conclude our Q&A session.
Thanks again, everybody, for joining us. I just want to mention that if you didn't email me and you would like California CLE credit for this call, just send me an email at koconnor@acslaw.com. ASCAS.org. And thank you so much, Jim, John, and Chuck, for joining us today, and congratulations on a great win. Thanks, everyone. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Katie.
Thanks very much.
This concludes today's call. Have a wonderful day.